Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect it is 1:35 p.m. on Friday, May 13th, 2022. Happy Friday the 13th, everybody. Present today, we have Representative Thompson, Representative Carpenter, Representative LaVon, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Josephson, Representative Johnson, and myself, Co-Chair Merrick. This afternoon, we will consider amendments to Senate Bill 131, Workers' Comp Disability for Firefighters, Senate Bill 173, Dentist Specialty License, Radiological Equipment, Senate Bill 20, Teacher Reciprocity, and Senate Bill 243 on PCE. First, we have Senate Bill 131, Workers' Comp Disability for Firefighters by Senator Holland. The committee heard an introduction of this bill on May 5th, and it's our second hearing. Amendments were due to my office today at 12:30, and we have three amendments before us for consideration. I do not see, I'll acknowledge that Senator Wilson is here. I do not see Senator Holland. Oh, Ms. Rose, are you here to represent the senator? Lovely. Do you have any opening comments before we move to public testimony? Okay, thank you so much. And with that, I'm opening public testimony on Senate Bill 131. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify? Seeing none, is there anyone online? Brief at ease. Thank you, House Finance on the record at 137. It looks like in Juneau with the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association, we have Richard Etheridge. Welcome to House Finance. Please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony. And let the record reflect at 137, we're joined by Representative Edgman. Mr. Etheridge.
Thank you very much. My name is Richard Etheridge. I'm the president of the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association. I'm calling you today to ask for your support in passing SB 131. I've been a firefighter for more than 30 years here in Alaska and a chief officer for more than half that time. During my career, we've learned that many job-related things have been documented to unequivocally cause cancer in firefighters. First, structure fire smoke causes cancer. That was not a huge mental leap for us to understand. Then later, we learned the soot buildup in our gear also causes cancer. We then learned that the buildings we were living in caused cancer due to the diesel exhaust residue that coated everything. A decade ago, we learned that the foam we use caused cancer and are also responsible for kidney problems. We've also recently learned that the protective equipment that we wear on our bunker gear has PFAS built into the protective fabrics. With each of these revelations, we develop new ways to protect our firefighters through engineering and training and technology, not to stop the cancers, but to reduce the risk as much as possible. If a firefighter gets a cancer diagnosis, they open up a workers' comp claim. If their cancer is on the presumptive list, they just have to prove they met the strict requirements to qualify for the program. If they can do that, then their cancer is covered like any other workplace illness. If their cancer is not on the presumptive list, it still may be a workplace illness. They just now have a harder job to prove which incidents and the circumstances that caused the cancer. Whether it's a presumptive case or a proven case, municipalities are still liable for the same exact expenses. SB 131 doesn't create additional liabilities for municipalities. It simply says that if you get an approved cancer, we're not going to force you to go through a protracted bureaucratic process if you meet the presumptive criteria. If it's a workplace illness, the municipality has no new liability. AML and their insurance partners are asking you not to move the presumptive health forward this year based on fear of what that impact might be. If presumptive health is going to be a problem, there might have been clues to that in the last dozen years this has been in place. According to the Workers' Comp Office, there have been very few actual claims filed. The state insurance director testified at the last hearing that the cost to the state was so negligible that it wasn't measured. This is also found to be consistent across other states that have presumptive health. When the original presumptive health bill was written, the number of female firefighters was very small. We've strived for diversity in our ranks now that we have many women firefighters, and they're not uncommon. Don't you think they deserve no longer be discriminated against? Don't they deserve cancer protection equal to their male counterparts? In this election year, it's easy to stand in front of your community and tell your local fire chiefs and firefighters you support emergency services. Firefighters from across the state and across Alaska are standing up and asking our elected representatives to demonstrate that support by passing SB 131. Please don't stall this important piece of protective legislation based on any fears of what the potential might be. Please pass SB 131.
Thank you very much, Mr. Etheridge. Are there questions from the committee? Seeing none, we appreciate you taking the time to call in. Is there anyone else online wishing to testify? Seeing none and no one in the room, we will close public testimony on Senate Bill 131. We have two fiscal notes to review. The first is fiscal note number 3 by the Division of Risk Management, control code FOZPB. It looks like we have Scott Jordan from the division online. Welcome. If you could place yourself on the record and review the fiscal note. Oh, we have you in person. I thought I saw you back there. Thank you so much for coming today.
For the record, I'm Scott Jordan, Director of Risk Management for the Department of Administration. You want me just to review, go quickly over the fiscal note?
Yes, thank you. That would be wonderful.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The fiscal note we have is the OMB component number 71 for risk management. It's an indeterminate amount based on the fact that we have no data in our system regarding cancer diseases with firefighters. We did attach in the analysis some of the average costs for cancers that we looked up. It certainly doesn't mean that this is going to be the most. It's just the average that we found online. And one of the other items that we added to this fiscal note is if a firefighter was to become deceased due to the disease that they caught or that they had the cancer, there's some death benefits that would go to their dependents.
Great, thank you. Questions on fiscal note 3? Seeing none, thank you very much, Mr. Jordan. We appreciate your time. Our second fiscal note is OMB component number 344, fiscal note IAIPV by the Workers' Compensation Division. It looks like on Teams we have Division Director Charles Collins. Welcome, Mr. Collins. If you could place yourself on the record, please, and review your fiscal note.
Charles Collins with the Workers' Compensation Department of Labor, and our fiscal note also shows it's a zero fiscal note for the division, as the division covers no firefighters, so there would be no extra expense for us. And we have the only analysis that I was able to add from the actuary is that they wouldn't be able to give us a number on costs, so I put their synopsis in there.
Great, thank you. Questions for Mr. Collins? I see none, and I will also note online we have Director of the Division of Insurance, Lori Wing Heyer, online if there are questions for her. Thank you, Mr. Collins. We appreciate you being here. With that, I see no questions. We will move to amendments. We have amendment number 1 by Representative Josephson. Do you have a motion?
Move amendment number 1.
I'll object for discussion. Representative Josephson.
Yes. Amendment number 1 is an amendment that is identical to a bill that we passed out of this committee and that passed by a vote of 29-10 on the House floor. That's House Bill 30, referred to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, scheduled. Yesterday that she's been working on something for 4 years, a very important thing.
Thank you. And let the record reflect, at 1:38 p.m. we were joined by Representative Wohl. Further discussion on amendment number one? Seeing none, I remove my objection. Is there further objection? Hearing none, amendment number one has been adopted. Amendment number two by Representative Ortiz. Is there a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment number two.
I'll object for discussion. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Amendment number two is a self-contained issue related to the Fisherman's Fund. When I say self-contained, meaning there's not going to be any fiscal cost, added fiscal cost to workman's comp or to the state's fiscal obligations or local municipalities' fiscal obligations. Doesn't have anything to do with that. It's just a self-contained fund. And what this does is it adds the COVID-19 portion of what the Fireman's Fund bill does to the Fisherman's Fund. And again, no cost to anybody other than the fishermen themselves, and they've requested that that this benefit get added to their particular fund. Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion on Amendment 2? Representative Johnson. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the chair. Representative Johnson. I guess I'll try to answer your question in the sense that the virus, of course, spreads more rapidly when people are confined in a fishing area, like in a fishing boat, et cetera, close containment. But that's the issue here is whether or not people who are part of the Fisherman's Fund feel they need some added protection from COVID-19, added insurance protection, if you will. Their insurance, their health insurance, is from the Fisherman's Fund itself. So this may add to their premiums. It may add to some cost, but whatever costs that are associated with this, it's taken care of and been requested by the fishermen. And so that's the simple explanation for it.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. And so you're adding in the Fisherman's Fund to this as well?
Only in the sense that the theme of the bill itself addresses firemen's, so it matches the theme of the fund, because in the bill, it talks about COVID-19 and getting it added to workman's compensation. But that's the only reason why it matches is because it's a COVID-19 benefit. But the benefit itself, again, it's only about the fishermen, the fund itself, all paid for by the fishermen. It's their health insurance program is what it is. And so that's what this amendment is.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson? Thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I get the concept of an occupational disease. It's something that's specifically related to that occupation. And hernia, varicose veins, bronchitis, cold out there, orders, all those things. Or
you. And before we go to Representative Thompson, it looked like, Mr. Collins, did you have a comment regarding either Representative Johnson or Representative Carpenter's questions and comments?
Through the chair, this is Charles Collins, Director of Workers' Compensation. Fisherman's Fund insurance does not work like workers' compensation. It's merely a reimbursement of expenses to the boat or to the fisherman, and they do not pay premiums. They pay a fee on their license when they purchase it through Fish and Game, and so that cost has been the same, and the setup of the Fisherman's Fund has been set since before the state became a state. Conversely, I'm also not aware of any requests from the Fish Fund Council on coverage for COVID, so I'm a little, I'm surprised to hear this amendment, but it will not impact the cost to any claims because it's merely a fee that the fishermen charge themselves to cover the Fisherman's Fund, which is a reimbursement vehicle, not really insurance.
Okay, thank you. Representative Carpenter, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, on a follow-up, on that, I guess that maybe the question ought to be posed, why is the common cold and influenza excluded here?
Can I have a brief at ease?
Brief at ease. House Finance on the record at 1:53 p.m. At 1:51, we were joined by Representative Rasmussen, Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's some questions here, reasonable questions, and to be quite honest, I'm not the person to be answering them. So I'm going to withdraw the amendment at this time, and we'll get the answers to the questions.
Great. Thank you very much. So we will roll Amendment 2. And that will take us to... It looks like conceptual amendment number 1 by Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move conceptual amendment number 1.
I'll object for discussion. Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Conceptual amendment number 1, if you look at the bill on page 1, line 13, it deletes skin cancer and replaces it with malignant melanoma. And then on page 2, if you look at page 2, beginning on line 4, following prostate cancer, the word and is added. The following lines are deleted, 6 through 12. So the that paragraph would end after the word and with breast cancer. Then the following cancers would be deleted. Trying to strike a balance between a reasonable risk and versus costs and the burden that would befall munis, cities, and organized boroughs. The original version of this bill simply added breast cancer to the list of cancers. Firefighters have a presumption and that a claim for workman's comp might result through their employment. To the limited number of claims, breast cancer did not seem to have a significant impact on workers' compensation rates paid by the state and municipality employers of firefighters. Madam Chair, the House Labor and Commerce Committee added the 7 additional cancers that I listed and proposed for removal. The indeterminate fiscal note of the House Labor and Commerce Committee substitute only shows possible costs to the state as an employer of airport firefighters. The AML, we heard from Mr. Andreessen here when this bill was before the committee, suggested that Alaska municipal communities, towns, cities, boroughs had raised concerns and suggested that the state consider capitalizing a trust fund that would cover these presumptive conditions. At this point in the session, it's difficult to evaluate that sort of a proposed solution. So this change will help reduce the uncertainty to our communities while consideration of those additional cancers can be raised at a future time if we deem appropriate. So with that, I would appreciate support to conceptual amendment number one.
Thank you, Representative LeBond. Further discussion on conceptual amendment one?
Aye.
Representative Josephson? Yes, we do.
Yes. My memory is that Ms. Green hired, Sam Burt, that she testified that she didn't believe this would cost the state very much. They're uncommon. And so for that reason alone, as someone who is familiar with the topic,
thank you. And we have Director of the Division of Insurance, Ms. Lori Wing-Hire, online. Could you place yourself on the record and comment on Representative Josephson's statement?
Certainly, Madam Chair. For the record, this is Lori Wing-Hire. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. And Representative Josephson is remembering my remarks correctly. We do not have data, and it's not just Alaska, but the other jurisdictions that are expanding their benefits for firefighters. With the presumptions, and every state has them, and ours are pretty strict, these pieces are few and far between. And there is not a trend for any actuary or insurer to say or attest that this bill, with one cancer or 10 cancers, is going to have an impact on the cost to the firefighting organization. Maybe it will at some point, but at this point, there's so few and far between. There's no data to suggest that this is going to raise the rates.
Thank you very much, Representative.
I hope that helps.
That's wonderful. Representative LeBond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Ms. Is it Weingartner?
Wing-Hire.
I'm sorry, Wing-Hire. Thank you for calling in. Could you help me understand how many firefighters that would fall under this bill that are state employed versus how many might be employed by cities, boroughs, municipalities?
Through the chair, and again, this is Lori Wing-Hire. Representative LeBond, I would have to get back to you on that. What I can tell you is that many of the smaller fire departments, the Chubiak fire departments, the Cooper Landing, those fire departments that are surviving on bake sales are not going to be able to afford to have their members get an annual physical to ever qualify for this. As for the number of state firefighters, I know that Director Jordan is in the hearing, and he might have some numbers for you. Other than that, I need to get back to you, sir, on it. I just don't have it off the top of my head.
Thank you.
If I could, with a follow-up.
Yes, would you like to hear from Mr. Jordan?
Well, maybe one quick question, then we can maybe expand this debate. Who bears the cost of the risk, if you will, for a municipality or a city or a borough with their volunteer fire departments or their city paid or city supported fire departments? Would that be the municipality versus the state?
Through the record, again, this is Lori Wing-Hire, and yes, if the employer of record would pay the cost for the workers' compensation claim if they were self-insured, or for the workers' compensation insurance if that's how they funded their program.
And I guess, Madam Chair, that would be the big difference. I'm talking about the bigger population, and she's answering regarding the smaller population.
Okay. Mr. Jordan, do you have an answer to Representative Lamont's question? Thank you for being here again.
Yeah, again, this is Scott Jordan, Director of Risk Management for Department Administration. Through the chair, we did a check with payroll, and there's 1,300 firefighters working for the state, but a majority of those are seasonal DNR forest firefighters. I think there's about 100 of those, or to 120, that are working for the airports that are full time.
Representative LeBond.
Thank you, Mr. Jordan. Would you have a estimate number? I'm thinking just the major communities: Fairbanks, Anchorage, Juneau, Kenai, Wasilla, the major city, borough, and municipalities that employ firefighters. What's the difference in the two groups, the number size?
Through the chair, I don't have that number. I suspect it's quite a bit higher than what we have working for the state.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'd like to ask what the response director calling us to weigh in on the questions in the hearing. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you. Mr. Collins, did you hear Representative Thompson's question?
Through the chair, this is Charles Collins for workers' compensation. Representative Thompson. So under workers' compensation, Anchorage Municipality, Mat-Su Borough, Kenai Borough, Fairbanks North Star Borough, and the city and borough of Juneau, and maybe even the Gateway Borough or Ketchikan, those are all self-insured, what we call self-insured entities. And so any fire department members under them would be, you know, that would be paid under self-insurance, much like the state does also, and so that would be covered by them. Those are the only entities I'm aware of. I cannot speak to the amount. We don't track the employees of those organizations by, you know, whether they're firefighters or, you know, street sweepers or whatever. So I can't speak to how many firefighters are at any of those, but it is a consideration that the self-insured entities would probably outnumber for firefighters easily what the two airports would cover. So, best I can do.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Collins.
Great. Representative LeBon and then Josephson.
Yes, Madam Chair. Could we invite Mr. Andreessen to return to the table as a representative of the AML? Maybe he could shed some light into how many folks are we talking about? How big is that population? He's probably the one that's better able to answer that in this room.
Thank you. Mr. Andreessen, welcome.
Thank you. For the record, Nils Andreessen, Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League. I think Representative LeBond through the chair. I think our understanding is more than 1,000 municipal firefighters that we're talking about. I want to maybe focus on the distinction that just came up, self-insured employers versus those who are not. So the larger municipalities are going to be self-insured. They're going to manage their risk independently of other municipalities. And so for them, they're going to be managing the impacts of this bill on their own. In your documents, you'll see letters from both APEI and AMLJIA. Those are both pools that were formed under statute to allow for risk sharing. So all the other smaller municipalities are members of those pools. The impacts of this bill then would be felt by every other employer, a municipal employer in the state, from the city of Kuitluk, the Russian mission, to Kotzebue and Kodiak, as long as they're part of those pools. So there's a distinction between an employer picking up the cost and a pool picking up the cost. And a pool is going to have very different assets available to deal with those claims. It's not going to come from the employer. It's going to come from the pool with a limited asset base to respond to. Even just infrequent claims could quickly have pretty challenging impacts to those pools.
Thank you very much. Representative Josephson.
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to think of who's best situated for this question, and I'm going to choose Ms. Wing-Hyer. My question is regarding malignant melanoma, and she may say this is not my area of specialty, but do we believe that malignant melanoma refers to a precancerous skin condition which would allow for denial of claims? In other words, the inference of where I'm going here is skin cancer a broader thing than malignant melanoma?
Ms. Wing-Hyer?
Through the chair, again, this is Lori Wing-Hyer, the director of the Division of Insurance. Through the chair again, Representative Josephson, you're absolutely right. I don't have the answer to that. I'm sorry.
Believe the doctor.
We've got, I think we've got a banker and a couple of former teachers.
What good are they?
Mr. Collins, are you raising your hand there, sir?
Charles Collins, Director of Workers' Compensation, through the chair to Representative Josephson. I might point out that the change to skin cancer actually was from, in statute, and I'm sorry I can't read it from memory, but it's already in statute, melanoma is, and it was changed, that was a change in labor and commerce to the broader term of skin cancer. So if I'm not mistaken, the amendment would merely change it back to what it really is written now.
Thank you very much. Sir. Representative Josephson.
My question is largely answered. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wolf.
Yeah, thank you. I'm not a doctor, but I think malignant melanoma is skin cancer. You might want to Google that one.
Thank you. Further discussion on Conceptual Amendment 1. Representative Josephson.
Sorry, I've been looking. We all carry computers with us, Madam Chair, and I saw a CDC report from 2016 that indicates firefighters are subject to cancers like testicular cancer, multiple myeloma, and those are listed here. And again, I don't think this is going to be terribly impactful, and I trust in my Labor and Commerce co-chairs to have, along with Representative Kaufman, not come up with these additions randomly. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further on Conceptual Amendment 1? Seeing none, I will maintain my objection. Madam Clerk, if you would please call the roll on Conceptual Amendment Number 1.
Representative Lebon.
Yes.
Representative Ortiz.
Pass.
Representative Rasmussen. Representative Thompson. Representative Wolf. Representative Carpenter.
Yes.
Representative Edgman. Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
No.
Representative Ortiz.
No.
Representative Rasmussen. Representative Foster.
No.
Representative Merrick.
No.
Three yeas. Oh, Representative Johnson.
No.
Three yeas, seven nays.
And with a vote of three yeas and seven nays, Conceptual Amendment Number 1 has failed to be adopted. Representative Ortiz, are you prepared for Amendment 2?
Madam Chair, Representative Ortiz won't be offering Amendment Number 2.
Amendment number 2 has been withdrawn. That takes us to discussion on Senate Bill 131 as amended. Any discussion?
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
This is a very fine bill that is not costly and will help Alaskans. We'll keep them healthier and safer.
Thank you very much. Further discussion? Representative Foster?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move...
No discussion.
No discussion.
Representative Carpenter?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I do have a follow-up question from previous discussion regarding how the International Agency for Research on Cancer or the National Toxicology Program actually define what an exposure is. And we heard through public testimony that there are diesel particles at the fire station, smoke at the fire, the actual event, the fire, soot residue on PPE, and then the makeup of the PPE or the manufacturer, the way they manufacture the PPE, are all things that have been deemed hazardous. I'm curious how those organizations are defining exposure in this regard.
Thank you. Any further comment on that, Ms. Rose? Welcome. Please place yourself on the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Nikki Rose, staff for Senator Holland. We have heard testimony in several committees before from the firefighters that the exposure is logged by Alaskan firefighters. When they go into buildings and they come out of those buildings, there are incident logs where the firefighters are then told to record what chemicals they were exposed to the best of their abilities. And those incident logs log the information, the chemicals, as well as the incident dates. And those records are kept so that at the time, this legislation, the statute says that after a period of 7 years of them having medical annual exams with no cancer present, that at the end of those times that they have an opportunity to look again at that information in those logs. So the exposure would then be presented to them in a log format that is date stamped, and the firefighter department keeps those logs.
Thank you very much. Further discussion on Senate Bill 131. Representative Carpenter.
This is a follow-up to that. Does it indicate then any time a firefighter puts on their PPE that they then file a record in a log that they've been exposed?
Ms. Rose?
Through the chair, to Representative Carpenter, I do not know the answer to that. I don't believe so, but it is possible we can get that answer from the firefighters.
If we still, looks like we still have Alaska Fire Chiefs Association Richard Etheridge with us. Are you able to answer that question, sir?
Yes, I can.
Thank you. If you'd place yourself on the record again.
This is Richard Etheridge with the Fire Chiefs Association. We do keep detailed training records that identify what trainings occurred, and with all of those trainings we're required to wear our protective equipment. And any time we go into a fire response or a hazardous materials response or any of that type of stuff, they're required to wear that equipment. If somebody was just putting on their bunker gear in a fire station, there's no record of that. That's just a normal course of business from day to day, but it is documented through responses and training records.
Follow-up, Representative Carpenter?
Not now. I'm not sure how to get to the answer without actually looking at these two organizations' documentation or something. The definition of exposure, if the material, first, let's say the PPE equipment, is carcinogenic, and I can put it on in a training manner, meaning I'm not fighting a fire, that's not an exposure, but I put it on and I'm fighting a fire and that is an exposure. The firefighter is deciding when he's exposed. And here, the law is saying that an exposure is defined by the International Agency Research Cancer or National Toxicology Program. So I don't understand whether the process is taking the individual and saying, I was exposed all these times, or whether the agencies are defining when they can consider when they've been exposed. There's a distinction there that I'm not hearing.
Mr. Etheridge, do you have any further comment on that?
We don't have any comments as far as how they define the exposure based on those organizations, but we just, like within the last year and a half, just found out about the PFAS in the bunker gear fabric. So this is brand new, and you know, it just kind of shows the trend of all the new crazy things that could potentially cause cancer that we're discovering every year.
Thank you very much. We appreciate that. Representative Johnson.
I'm just going to offer a comment.
Yes, please.
I was in the research I was doing for this bill, and I don't know if it really applies, but I do know more recently that they're discovered that the firefighting equipment, when they're wearing it, still has cancer-causing elements to it. If you've been exposed, if it's been in the fire and with things that are cancer-causing, so one of the safety things that they do is to take that equipment and they separate you from that during, after the fire or whatever, so you're not around that equipment at the same time. Is that what you're trying to say? Is your exposure maybe not defined just by how long you're in the fire, but also in the equipment that's been associated with the cancer-causing elements?
Representative Carpenter.
So I have some personal experience with this, not in fighting fires, but with wearing PPE that's supposed to protect you from hazardous things, right? So in the military, we would put on gear, and luckily I've never had to wear it in real life because I would be protecting against anthrax or some other deadly agent, right? And so if I was exposed to anthrax, I would know it because I'm going to die or get sick. There's decontamination processes that we go through when we put on our PPE to protect us from the environment. If I'm exposed to a deadly agent and it's still on my uniform, I have to decontaminate it when I've taken it off, and I can still be exposed to it at that time, and I would be dead if I did. So my question is trying to understand, because the law is specifically saying that firefighter was exposed to a known carcinogen as defined by these two organizations, not by the borough or the city or the firefighter, it's by these two organizations. So I'm trying to understand how the organizations are defining exposure, because the firefighter is not dying immediately when he takes his gear off, and I don't know whether he's actually being exposed when he takes his gear off. They're telling us under what circumstances they're defined as exposed.
Ms. Rose, is it possible for you to try to either contact those organizations or do some research on that to help Representative Carpenter?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just told by the firefighters, for the record, this is Nikki for staff for Senator Holland, that the ARC and NTP list and categorize what are known carcinogens. They likely have to prove that the exposure took place. And in the case was before the Workers' Compensation Board. So the board would be presented with the information and they would refer back to the list of the known carcinogens. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anything further, Representative Carpenter? Thank you, Ms. Rose. Further discussion on Senate Bill 131? Seeing none, Mr. Kocher, do you have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 131, version 32-LS0598-G, from committee as amended with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note, and authorize legislative legal services to make conforming changes.
Is there an objection? Hearing none. Senate Bill 131 is moved from committee. Thank you, and brief at ease. Thank you. House Finance on the record at 2:22 p.m. Next, we will take up Senate Bill 173, Dentist Specialty License, Radiological Equipment by Senator Wilson. Welcome back, Senator. We heard an introduction of this bill on May 5th, and it's our second hearing. We had an amendment deadline today, and we received no amendments. Senator, do you have opening comments before we move to public testimony? Seeing none, thank you. I will open public testimony on Senate Bill 173. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify? Seeing no one, is there anyone online wishing to testify? Seeing no one, I am closing public testimony on Senate Bill 173. We have three fiscal notes. The first is from the Department of Commerce, Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing, OMB component number 2360. It looks like we have Sarah Chambers, Division Director, online. If you could place yourself on the record and review the fiscal notes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, this is Sarah Chambers, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. Our fiscal note has several components because the bill has two primary purposes. One is to reinstitute specialty licensing, which will require us to add several new licenses and additional work to our team. So we are requesting one additional occupational licensing examiner. Currently, this large program only has one dedicated staff member. The other major component is our need to cooperate and coordinate with Health and Social Services on radiological equipment administration. So we are entering into or plan to enter into an interagency agreement with Health and Social Services at the amount of $224,000, and this is an amount that is reflected on our services line, and I believe it is also reflected in one of the HESS fiscal notes because it is the same dollar. We just have to account for it in one division and out in the other division.
Thank you very much, Ms. Chambers. Are there questions regarding this fiscal note? I see none. We appreciate you being... Oh, Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I was curious to know what the assessment is on how many inspections, equipment inspections, are expected to have to be done annually.
Ms. Chambers?
Thank you. This is Sarah Chambers, and we have estimated that there are about 6,000 pieces of equipment that would have to be, or, 2,000 pieces of equipment that would have to be inspected every 6 years. That's based on our current registrations, and so the cost, which the Health and Social Services component could speak more specifically to, since they'll be doing that work. That cost would be a rolling cost across those 6 years to ensure that a position could support all of that inspection across the state. So I have the high-level overview, and Health and Social Services may have a more granular look at that particular number.
Follow up?
I guess that breaks down just roughly to less than one piece of equipment per day, like 0.9 pieces of equipment per day that need to be inspected. Just quickly, so besides conducting the inspections, what is the additional hire going to be doing?
Through the chair, this is Sarah Chambers. For our division, we are no longer going to be doing inspections. We're handing that, this bill hands that off to Health and Social Services, so they could speak to those inspection routines that they're planning for. The occupational licensing examiner, which would be the new hire in our division, is to be able to take on the extra work that the new specialty licensing scheme that this bill reintroduces, it will mandate. We have one person for this about 7,000 licensing, 7,000 dentists, dental hygienist licensing program, and we can't expand the program further without additional staff support.
Thank you. Do we have DHS on?
We have two remaining fiscal notes, and it looks like people from healthcare services and public health.
I'll hold that question until we get there.
Yes, thank you. Anything further? Seeing none, we will move to our second fiscal note from the Division of Public Health, OMB component number 2252. We have Dr. Jamie Parker from the division online. Please put yourself on the record and begin your fiscal note review.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, I am Dr. Jamie Parker, Chief of the State Public Health Lab, part of the newly developed Department of Health and the Division of Public Health, where I currently manage a radiological health program. So the fiscal note for DOH lab starts with an initial investment of $193,200. That allows us to recruit for and hire an additional radiological health physicist to help us monitor and register and inspect an additional of what we think is 2,200 to potentially 2,400 devices out there. We currently manage about 1,000, so we will require an additional personnel to assist us with that. We're also suggesting an additional office assistant to help us with communication with Commerce, because they will be collecting the fees, we will be invoicing, and we need that communication. That person will also be helping with the travel for two radiological health specialists. Beyond FY23 and that initial investment, we see an increase to $224,200, and that is increased because we assume that it will take us at least 3 or 4 months to hire somebody in FY23, so we won't need that whole salary and benefit until FY24. So that $224,000, we expect to be covered by fees. As mentioned before, it does come out to be about one device per day, but we can do more than one device in a day. And we also have other X-ray equipment that we inspect across Alaska, so we intend to cross-train these two people. We will send one person out to do X-rays and dental equipment, let's say if we send somebody to Kodiak Island. So we think that the travel will actually be reduced overall. And just for the dental board and for the dentists across Alaska, this comes out to be roughly about $100 per device per year. So if you divide that 224 by, you know, 367 or 370 devices per year, that comes out to be about $600 per device, and that's going to last them 6 years, because we are, by regulation, supposed to register and inspect these devices every 6 years. So that's where we get the $100 estimate per device. So if there's any other questions, I'm happy to take them. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Parker. Questions regarding this fiscal note? Thank you very much for being here, Doctor. We will move to our third fiscal note, which is OMB Component 242 from Healthcare Services. We have Jason Ball from the Division of Healthcare Services. If you could please place yourself on the record and begin your review of your fiscal note. Thank you for being with us.
Good afternoon, for the record. Jason Ball, Quality Assurance Manager for Healthcare Services, and I appreciate the opportunity to connect here today. Our fiscal note comes in at roughly $92,000 per year on the personal services line, as well as then some additional commodity expenditure as it relates to the setting up of this new position for the bill. So generally speaking, we see an impact to the Medicaid provider enrollment component as it relates to the specialty piece and implementing the specialty licenses. Federal government requires us to, at both initial enrollment and revalidation at the 3 or 5 year interval, depending on a provider's risk level, we're required to take up a body of work to ensure that our providers are practicing in the specialties that they're approved to do. In addition to that, we have a post-payment review that looks at provider specialty, and with the scope of change that this bill takes into consideration, we need to, on an ongoing basis, ensure the integrity of the claims that are billed on behalf of those newly created specialists, so we can draw down federal funds. And with that, open to questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ball. We appreciate it. Do you or Dr. Parker either have answers to help Representative Carpenter with his questions, if you heard them previously? I hear no one chiming in. Would you like to repeat your question, Representative Carpenter? We also have David Nelson, the chair of the Dental Board, Dr. David Logan with the Alaska Dental Society online.
Good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you, folks, for providing clarification on the fiscal notes. We sure appreciate it. Further discussion on Senate Bill 173? Seeing none, Mr. Kocher, do you have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 173, version 32-LS0865-W from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note, and authorize legislative legal services to make conforming changes.
Thank you. Is there an objection? Hearing none, Senate Bill 173 is moved from committee. Thank you, Senator. Brief at ease. House Finance on the record at 2:33 p.m. Next, we have Senate Bill 20, Out-of-State Teacher Reciprocity by Senator Stevens. We heard this bill on May 11th. Amendments were due to my office yesterday, and we have one amendment before us. We have Senator Stevens' staff, Tim Lampkin, with us. Do you have any opening comments before we move to amendments? Seeing none, we have amendment number one by Representative Thompson. Do you have a motion? I'll object for discussion. Representative Thompson.
Basically, what Amendment 1 does is it changes in Section 1. It adds a new subsection, AS 1403080, allows a student who does not reside in a state to continue to attend public schools through a district or statewide study program as long as the student is a dependent of a member of the Armed Forces, of the Alaska National Guard, the Alaska Naval Militia, excuse me, or the Alaska State Defense Fund Force. The student has to be a state resident as defined in the Permanent Fund Dividend Statute. Parents are being transferred or the pending transfer to military installations outside of the district while on active duty and was a resident or of a school district immediately before the transfer. It will change Section 2, AS 1417-500, student count estimate. Under this statute, districts provide their projected student count for the succeeding fiscal year, which is due on November 5th each year. These numbers are used by DEED for budgeting purposes only. If a district anticipates having a child that falls under this, then the district will want to include that student in their projected average daily membership count. And in Section 3, it changes AS 1417-600 student count period. This is the statute where districts provide their actual student count for the 20-day period in October. These numbers are due to DEED within 2 weeks from the end of the count period. If a district has a child that falls under AS 1403080G, then the district should include that student in their actual average daily membership count. If this amendment is adopted, a title change resolution will be required. And this was brought to us by a military family that wants to stay with the school district that they have been remotely using. This just makes sense that even as stated here, if they qualify for the permanent fund dividend, they are required to say that they will be moving back to the state of Alaska and that this is their residence. And that's Amendment 1.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, through the chair.
this strikes me as that it could be indefinite, and so that we're paying for a Florida child's education for 11 years if they left in the first grade. Is that possible?
They have to qualify for the permanent fund, and if I remember right, even military members that try to continue to qualify for a permanent fund dividend have to return to the state every 2 years, is it? I believe it. I'm not sure. There is a requirement on the PLD whether they have to come back to the state, not to reestablish residency, but they have to at least come back to the state to show their intent that they plan to be back.
Great, thank you. Further discussion? Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. We've seen all these formulas from DEED in the past, and I don't know if they're online, but this Section 2, a child who's attending public school for a correspondence study program may be counted as a student for the purpose of calculating the ADM of the correspondence program. I thought that's how they calculate the formula that goes to that district, because they're counting them as part of the ADM. In other words, if Fairbanks, let's say a bunch of kids go to the Galena School District Correspondence School, Galena, okay, thanks. So let's say they register for the Correspondence School IDEA, which is housed in the Galena School District. Galena would count them as part of their ADM and get the BSA number, amount, with whatever multipliers or not, depending on what they get. So I thought that's already happening. I don't know what this change means.
Thank you. And it looks like online we have Deborah Riddle, Operations Manager at DEED, and we also have Sandra Meredith with the Department of Education and Early Development. I think we'll go ahead and start with Ms. Meredith to see if you have an answer for Representative Wohl on that question.
Maybe get the bill sponsor and the staff up to the table to talk about it. I feel this is a bigger than just sort of one perspective. I know I'm kind of jumping in line here. This amendment is multi-dimensional to me in some ways, and it's the point where I don't understand it.
Okay. We'll let Representative Wohl finish his question, and then we can go to the sponsor.
Okay.
Okay, Ms. Meredith?
Good afternoon. This is Sandra Meredith. I'm going to pass this question over to Deb Riddle. She's much more knowledgeable in this area.
Great. Thank you. Ms. Riddle, please place yourself on the record.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Thank you very much.
Hi. So this is Deborah Riddle with the Department of Education and Early Development. Can you repeat the question?
Representative Wohl.
Thank you. We have in front of us an amendment. And towards the bottom of the page, starting in line 20, and I don't know if you have the amendment in front of you, Section 2, subsection D. Is this subsection D, lines 21 through 23, is that existing statute? Is that changing anything? And I'm looking to the next section, C. A child who's attending public school through a correspondence study may be included in the report required under... I guess if a child is in correspondence, they get counted in that district where the correspondence school is housed. Isn't that what's happening currently in law?
Yes, through the chair, that is correct.
Can you please place yourself on the record, Ms. Riddle?
Oh, I'm sorry. For the record, Deborah Riddle, through the chair, that is correct.
Thank you very much. Representative Wohl.
Thank you. As a follow-up, is this section, Section 2, and Section 3, is that new law, or is that, I don't understand what this amendment does if it's just adding new law, unless there's some other changes in the Section 1. But is this already in statute, what we're amending right now?
Through the chair, this is Deborah Riddle. It is happening right now for in-state students.
Representative Wohl.
So I guess the amendment sponsor can explain. This is only for those students that are out of state taking correspondence because they're either just left Alaska or about to come into Alaska and qualify for these other qualifications up above. I guess that's really what the thrust of this. I'm just trying to understand the amendment the first time I've seen it.
Representative Thompson?
Did I explain it right?
I thought you had.
Okay, then we'll proceed with the bill sponsor.
Great, thank you. Senator Stevens is with us and his staff, Tim Lampkin. Thank you for being with us today. If you could place yourself on the record and perhaps comment on amendment number one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Gary Stevens, District R. I've just seen the amendment, and just let me say we have a tremendous problem in this state with teacher shortage. This bill helps solve it. Not all of it, but helps solve part of it. The bill does not lower standards. It simply cuts red tape. It allows teachers in good standing from other states who are certificated to come to our state and very quickly become certificated teachers in our school system. It's supported by school districts. And looking at the amendment, this has nothing to do with the bill. Nothing to do with the bill. I mean, do what you want. We always do these nasty things at the end of the end of session. This is a very simple bill. It's needed. People want it. Please don't mess it up with this amendment.
Thank you. Further discussion on Amendment 1? Seeing none, in wrap-up, Representative Thompson?
Madam Co-Chair, basically this is trying to make it to where that a military family that has a student in school here in Alaska temporarily gets transferred in the military to another state, another district, another post, and this would allow them to continue to be part of and have that education paid for through the DSA. This is, I feel like it's only right. These are going to be people that are going to be moving back to Alaska. They qualify for the PFT, and to qualify, they have to say that they're going to move back. And these are just people that have had success with their correspondence course that they utilize at the present time. And I think this is only it's a good bill to help take care of our military members.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. I will maintain my objection. If the clerk could please call the roll on amendment number one.
Representative Ortiz.
No.
Representative Rasmussen. Representative Thompson.
Yes.
Representative Wolf.
Yes.
Representative Carpenter.
Yes.
Representative Edgman.
No.
Representative Representative Josephson.
Yes.
Representative Laban.
Yes.
Representative Rasmussen.
Yes.
Representative Wolf.
No.
Representative Merrick.
No.
Representative Foster.
No.
4 yeas, 6 nays.
With a vote of 4 yeas and 6 nays, amendment number one has failed to be adopted. Further discussion on Senate Bill 20? Any closing comments, Senator?
No, thank you very much, Madam Chair. We'll see the bill.
Thank you very much. With that, Mr. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. I would like to ask a question and maybe just get some clarification here. We are deleting out, and I'm looking at Section 3, we're deleting out the requirement to pass a competency examination. And instead, we're inserting the words complete education requirements under these two new statutes, H and K, 1420.20H and K, within 90 days. And those statutes are provided in Section 6 and 7. Section 6 deals with multicultural education or cross-cultural communications, and Section K deals with alcohol, drug-related disabilities, so basically relating to students with maybe learning disabilities, suicide prevention, dating violence. With the exception of those two statutes, what else, what is in the competency examination that's currently covered that's now going to be not covered? Because those two things are, those these subjects will be covered, but what's not going to be covered when we eliminate the competency exam.
Thank you. Senator?
Thank you. Through the chair. The goal here is to get the teachers into the system as quickly as possible, not to eliminate any of the responsibilities that they have to take suicide prevention classes, to take Alaska history or our cultural studies. They have to pass all of those things in time. And actually, maybe Tim can go over those specifics so you know exactly what those dates are.
Mr. Lampkin.
Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens, through the chair, Representative Carpenter. So I want to remind the body here that this bill is a direct result of emergency regulations that were written and adopted by the current administration in the context of COVID. And it resulted very successfully in districts getting teachers in their classrooms more quickly during that epidemic. The statute and the way it's crafted here is intended to, and is in alignment with those regulations, makes efficiencies there so those teachers, for example, don't take that company exam. It's presumed that they have done so when they've gotten their regular certification in another state. The other requirements for things such as sexual abuse awareness, alcohol, suicide prevention, those types of courses, the cultural awareness, that's nothing new there. It just gives them more time to complete those studies.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and I appreciate the need to address getting teachers into the state, because that's a need that we have. We also have other legislation in the building that is trying to address a reading deficiency problem. And I have been informed that there are baccalaureate degree programs from institutions of higher education that don't actually teach teachers how to teach our kids how to read. And I've been told that there are teachers that are employed in our state that don't know how to teach kids how to read. And therefore, we have legislation and money supposedly set aside here to correct that problem. We're going to eliminate a competency examination and trust that some other teacher from some other state does know how to teach our kids how to read. So I guess two questions I would have is, does the competency examination test or confirm whether a teacher knows how to teach kids how to read, especially if they're going to be hired in K through third grade? And if it does, how would we then assess whether an incoming teacher from another state who may have got a baccalaureate degree from an institution of higher education that didn't teach them how to teach kids how to read actually knows how to teach kids how to read? Because evidently we have that problem currently. But we're going to eliminate the competency examination. How do we confirm it?
And through the chair, I'll let Tim answer some of those specifics. But remember, what we're talking about here is hiring teachers by a district. They don't come to us. We don't hire teachers. But the legislature is not involved in that hiring process. The school district is. The superintendent is. And we're not changing that. I mean, they make that decision. They're not going to hire someone who's incompetent. They're not going to hire a teacher who can't teach. So remember, we're putting this in the hands of the school district. And Tim, could you, any specifics on that you care to add?
Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. I can only align myself with comments by Senator Stevens here. This is a concern that a lot of people have as we've gone through the committee process, the education committees in particular, carefully examining this. There's certainly very stringent processes that folks have to go through in order to get Alaska certification. And again, this was an effort to try to make it a little bit less burdensome, but not eliminate something such as a competency exam. And on that point, I'd very much like to defer or recall on Ms. Meredith as our specialist, who is the person that makes these approvals, to speak specifically to that.
Ms. Meredith?
Hello, this is Sandra Meredith. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
So could you repeat the question, please?
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. I will do my best. So the bill before us eliminates the requirement to pass a competency examination for out-of-state teachers being hired under this program, under this new statute, the changes to the statute. And the question I have is kind of a two-part question. Does the competency examination currently assess whether a teacher is competent in teaching reading, especially if they're going through to a K through third grade
then if we eliminate that competency examination, how would districts determine whether the training and the baccalaureate degree, whatever education that the teacher has received, has prepared them to teach kids how to read?
Ms. Meredith?
Yes, through the chair. This is Sandra Meredith with the Department of Education and Early Development. I administer teacher certification for the state. Representative Carpenter, currently the basic competency exam that we're referring to is a reading, writing, and math that is typically taken prior to an individual entering the classroom for student teaching. It's a basic exam. Most states have an exam of this nature already as part of their licensure requirement. The issues we have with veteran teachers coming in is often they have to, you know, find that paperwork and those documentation to present to the state of Alaska within a year. And this bill would remove that additional requirement for those teachers. As far as a competency test to assess an individual's ability to read or to teach reading, that is not, we do not have a test at this time that's specific to that area. There is proposals within other bills currently that is proposing that is something that we would require as a state. The other types of exams that are being taken or that are taken by teachers are content specific, and so currently an elementary teacher would take a broader test that would assess their ability to teach all content areas, not specifically just reading. So they're not, the tests that we provide or that we require now are very broad in nature. And those are right now currently regulatory requirements, not statutory requirements.
Follow up?
So if I understand correctly, there's a broad array of assessments. Are those going to change underneath this bill?
Through the chair, again, this is Sandra Meredith, administrator for teacher certification through the Department of Education. The only exam that would be removed, or the exam that would be removed as part of this bill, would be the basic competency exam requirement. Also, the additional regulatory requirements for content area exam.
I believe Representative Ortiz wanted to comment on your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In response, and maybe to contribute to the discussion going on here, in response specifically to the questions brought forward by the representative from Kenai, and being a former principal, I can kind of relate back to and tie us back to the initial answer brought forward by the sponsor of the bill. The process of determining the ability of a teacher to teach reading is not going to be covered in an objective exam. That's just not going to happen. So where that responsibility lies is in relationship to the district that's hiring and the principal and hopefully a hiring committee that gives a thorough, there's hopefully a number of applicants, and they go through a thorough process of determining through letters of recommendation and things like that the ability of the teacher to teach reading rather than relying on a specific exam. Again, it would be pretty hard to put together an objective exam, pencil and paper exam, to determine a teacher's ability to teach reading, particularly to primary age students. You just can't do that. So that's all I'll add to it.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. I guess I would just beg to differ. I think one of the other bills that we saw come up with subject matters such as phonics and phonetic understanding or phonetic reasoning, and there are undoubtedly concepts that are taught in some schools, but evidently not not all schools, about those concepts. And then, so I can think that there's probably a multiple choice test that you could put together that would test those knowledge on those areas. And if a teacher has knowledge in those areas, it would be representative on that exam. If we're not currently doing that in this competency exam that's required prior to we get a teacher certified to teach in the state, then maybe we've identified part of the problem if we can't teach reading adequately in our schools. So I don't know that removing the competency examination is equal to doesn't change standards. To me, if we're removing a competency examination and assuming that the competency from some other state is covering it, I don't know that that's in our best interest of our kids.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you. I can appreciate your line of questioning, certainly. I think that bill that was working through the committee is about the incoming, an assessment of an incoming primary age student and where their ability is in recognitions of basic reading skills. And so it's a measurement of their reading readiness, if you will, or their ability to read theoretically by the third grade is what you're hoping for. But that's a different thing than having a teacher come in and apply to a district. Certainly you wouldn't expect that person would have to show competence in reading or phonetics or those kinds of things, because you know that's not the question. The question is the ability to teach those things, and those are two different things. Having the skills to be a reader is a lot different than having the skills to be a teacher of reading. Those are two totally different things.
Okay, thank you. We're going to move to Representative Josephson.
Yes, I hope that my question goes a long way toward resolving this for myself. And the question is for the DEED staff, and I don't recall your name, but
Ms. Riddle?
Names. Sure. Through the chair, how many people who take the basic competency exam don't pass it?
That'd probably be Ms. Meredith.
Through the chair, this is Sandra Meredith, the Department of Education and Early Development. We have probably right in the neighborhood of probably 3 to 5%. Failure rate for the practice core basic competency exam. There are others that have been adopted, and there are abilities for the educator to go back and retake. Often on retake, they're successful, but it's often very difficult, especially in our rural community, for those retakes to take place. They have to often fly out and extra expense and time to meet that requirement.
Representative Josephson.
I think that satisfies me.
Thank you. Representative Ortiz.
And my question is, on that practice that you just spoke about, is it, assuming you have knowledge of what that practice and test includes, I can assume, I would bet, that it doesn't have anything in relationship to teaching reading itself, the skills of teaching reading to primary age students. Am I correct on that? You spoke previously about content, like basic math understanding, basic science understanding, content things, your knowledge of history, et cetera. That makes sense. You can test that. But does the praxis test the teacher's ability to teach reading?
Ms. Meredith?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, again, this is Sandra Meredith for the Department of Education and Early Development. That is correct. Though the basic competency exam does not test or look at the knowledge of somebody to teach reading, or the knowledge behind the science of reading. It's basically, can you read and comprehend is the area of being tested.
Thank you. Anything further? Representative Carpenter. Oh, pardon me, Representative Johnson. I didn't look at my paper.
So, given the state of our education system being number 49 in the nation, it feels like we just need more teachers and a teacher shortage. And I guess my biggest concern is not people that are qualified to teach in Alaska so much. I mean, I'd like to think that, I mean, I know we're talking about details and, you know, testing and so on. A bigger concern that I would have would be the unique conditions that they might encounter here. So more about having something for people to know what they're getting into, especially if they get into the bush. But that's not the point, right? The point is just to get to expand our teacher base by teachers that apparently are already here through being married to someone that's in the military that's here organically more than they're moving here. Is that correct?
Thank you, and I will recognize Representative Kronk has joined us. Thank you for being here. Senator Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Stevens speaking. Representative Johnson hit it right on the head, the nail on the head on this issue. The purpose of this bill is simply workforce development. That's what it's all about. It's in order to cut the red tape to get certificated teachers who are successful in other districts to be able to apply for these jobs and cut some of the red tape, allow our districts to make that decision if they are a teacher they want, if they have the training they want. I just remind you, talking about the military, when we had, I believe it was in this committee, the commissioner or the superintendent in Anchorage School said that 7% of her teachers were military spouses. And the advantage of getting them in early is sometimes they're only here for 2 or 3 years. And if you have to wait a year, as often happens, before they get accepted into our system, then we've lost that year or even longer. So, I'm only talking about the military. There are also others who apply who are not in the military who want to teach in Alaska and are certificated in other places. So, this is about workforce development, really. Thank you.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Johnson? Okay, Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and I do appreciate that we need more teachers. We don't need more teachers who fit into the category of the 3-5% failure rate of the practice test. We don't need those, but we're just going to assume that that's not going to happen anymore because we're not even going to conduct the competency exam. So we're just assuming that all the teachers that are coming in from out of state aren't going to fall into that category. So this is a concept that businesses and other military organizations have when they have a recruiting problem or a staffing problem. The question is, do we lower the standards to bring people in? We are removing a competency examination that has a 3-5% failure rate, and you say that we're not lowering the standards. How can you say that? We won't know. We won't know because we're not going to ask the question. We're not going to cause the person to sit before that competency exam that 3-5% people currently fail. So we won't know.
Thank you. Mr. Lampkin?
Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. I think it's timely to clarify Section 2 of the bill that the target population of this bill is presumed to have a set of teachers out there in the country that have years of experience and have, number one, a baccalaureate degree. They currently hold a valid, legitimate, regular teaching certificate in another state, and looking at what the regimen of other states' certification process always includes a competency exam of some kind. So all this bill's saying is it's giving them a nod that you have a legitimate professional teaching license in another state. We're recognizing that is a competency a completion, and therefore we're not going to make you take it again. It is an onerous test. We've got testimony in the past to that effect. It's expensive, it's timely, it sometimes relies on internet in the bush. That fails, and so after repeated efforts and several hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars attempting to take this test that they don't feel they need to take in the first place, it's resulted in this bill. I think Ms. Meredith on the department can help attest to this as well.
Ms. Meredith?
Through the chair, this is Sandra Meredith, administrator for education at the Department of Education and Early Development. I would concur with Mr. Lampkin. The cases that we see that are having difficulty often are those folks that are very remote, and again, they do end up being successful in taking the test. We do allow them to retake it. It's just very laborious, especially for those people that have years and years of experience.
Great. Thank you very much. Further discussion? Representative Carpenter.
Wait a second. Did I just hear that we have teachers with years and years of experience that have to take the competency exam multiple times?
Ms. Meredith?
Through the chair, that is correct. They do have to take a competency exam. They may have passed one in the past, but because of various aspects of the testing companies, they're unable to bring those exams forward to us, and so they have to retake another exam that sometimes is difficult for them to pass.
Follow-up?
Just a statement. I must protest. Removing requirement for a competency test that experienced teachers have a challenge passing is not reducing our standards. That is they are not equal.
Thank you, Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One more crack at the apple here. I can appreciate your concerns, and I understand. Everybody has a concern of not lowering the bar in relationship to the community of teachers that, you know, that are in our state. That concern was shared when we first started to look at this bill by other members of the committee. But the portion of the bill that doesn't require these incoming teachers to immediately take the competency, I hate to call it a competency exam because it doesn't measure the competency to teach. It just doesn't. It doesn't measure that. Okay? It measures content about your knowledge of history or math or those kinds of things. That's what it measures. Now, I can have all kinds of knowledge about history. I can have all kinds of knowledge about that. But that doesn't mean I can teach it. That doesn't have anything to do with teaching it. And so I agree. You know, it seems like this, quote, competency exam is going to be like, by not requiring people, it seems like, oh, to take it, that we're lowering our standards. But no, that it doesn't measure your competency to teach. It just doesn't. Okay? Where it's going to come in and where the responsibility lies is within the local district and the local hiring committees and the principal to look at the applicant and to look at their letters of reference, look at their years of experience, and determine whether that particular person is in the best interest of meeting their district's kids' needs in the classroom. And I can bet that they're not going to hire that person if they don't think that that person brings to the table the ability to provide good education to their students. Now, it might be a little bit further complicated by the fact that we're getting fewer and fewer applicants to become teachers, and so they might have to be a little bit more accepting of maybe where they wouldn't have been 15 years ago, but the competency exam is not going to change that situation. That's just not going to change it. So there you have it.
And I'm going to go to Representative Wool and then back to Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I appreciate the conversation, and I also appreciate the need to get teachers in schools. And I don't know if anyone on the phone can answer this. I know in Fairbanks there's a desperate need for substitute teachers. And on any given day, I believe there's hundreds of substitute teachers teaching kids. sometimes for a day or a week, but sometimes longer term. I've had kids that have subs for weeks that aren't teachers at all, and I don't even think they're required to have a degree of any kind. And I'm just curious if the person from DEED can tell us what percentage of teachers are subs on any one day. I think it's a pretty high number, and they're not certified teachers in any state. Some are retired, so I shouldn't say that. But, you know, I think we need to get teachers in schools, and I appreciate this effort. But can someone on the phone perhaps tell me on any given day what percentage or how many subs are teaching our kids?
Ms. Riddle?
Yes, this is Deb Riddle with the Department of Education and Early Development. We don't really have that information handy, but we can look into it and get that for you.
Great, thank you very much. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I am not going to be able, we are not going to be able to solve all of the education problems with this bill or with this discussion. I'm not even going to attempt to. All I'm saying is that if we are going to allow reciprocity for teacher certificates for teachers out of state, and we are not going to require a competency exam, then we are putting an awful lot of trust in processes and people that do not reside in this state. And if we already know that our current data shows that we have a percentage of experienced teachers who can't pass a competency exam, test, whatever you want to call it, whatever name you want to put to it, they're being asked to share their understanding of knowledge that's on that test, and our system has said that we need to have that for in-state teachers, then we're not doing our districts any favors by not certifying or by certifying teachers who have not passed that basic competency test.
Thank you. And with that, I'm going to give Senator Stevens an opportunity for final wrap-up.
Well, thank you. Interesting discussion here, but remember the point of this is to fill a shortage that we have with competent teachers, with teachers who have certificated or are certificated in other states. That doesn't mean that every certificated teacher that wants a job in Alaska is going to be accepted. Certainly not. They will go. I've been president of my school board. I've been on school boards for many years, and I know that the district is very, very, your district is very careful to make sure that they hire the proper teachers. They're not going to hire someone who is incompetent. That's simply not going to happen. Just remind you that 7% in Anchorage of those teachers are military spouses. If we don't pass this, we'll lose years and years of experience in our classroom. I think this doesn't solve it. You're right. This doesn't solve it. I make no attempt to say that this solves all of our problems, but it does help.
Thank you, Senator. And with that, we're going to take a brief at ease. House Finance on the record at 3:16. Thank you all for the very robust debate. And with that, Mr. Co-Chair, do you have a motion?
I do. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 20, version 32-LS0202/W from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes, and authorize legislative legal services to make conforming changes.
Is there an objection? Seeing an objection, Madam Clerk, if you would please call the roll on Senate Bill 20.
Representative Rasmussen.
Yes.
Representative Thompson.
Yes.
Representative Wool.
Yes.
Representative Carpenter. Representative Edgman. Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Josephson?
Yes.
Representative Laban?
Yes.
Representative Ortiz?
Yes.
Representative Foster?
Yes.
Representative Merrick?
Yes.
9 yeas, 1 nay.
And with a vote of 9 yeas and 1 nay, Senate Bill 20 is moved from committee.
Thank you,
Senator and Mr. Lampkin. We'll take a brief at ease. House Finance on the record at 3:19 p.m. Our final bill is Senate Bill 243, Power Cost Equalization, Raise Endow Fund Investment, by the Senate Finance Committee. Senator Hoffman's office is carrying this bill, and we last heard it on the 9th. Amendments were due to my office yesterday, and we have one amendment before us for consideration. Before we move to amendments, Mr. Grusendorf from Senator's office, I see no comments. With that, we will move to amendments number one by Representative Thompson.
Madam Co-Chair, I move amendment number one.
I'll object for discussion. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. This amendment adds bulk fuel upgrades to the list of types of projects that AS 4245085D2 and B may fund, which currently include the Renewable Energy Fund, the Bulk Fuel Revolving Loan Fund, and Rural Power System Upgrades. Adding bulk fuel upgrades to the list allows AEA to capture federal funds on a one-to-one basis if it undertakes any bulk fuel upgrades. And we have Curtis Sayer from AEA online that might explain the needs for having this.
Great, thank you. Mr. Thayer, welcome. If you could place yourself on the record. Mr. Thayer, are you on mute?
Sorry about that.
That's okay. Please place yourself on the record, and you can give your thoughts on amendment number one, please.
This is Curtis Thayer, and I serve as the executive director of the Alaska Energy Authority. And what amendment one does on HB 243 is there's a cascading waterfall of funds available depending on when the fund reaches a certain level of earnings. As we've discussed before in the committee, $30 million, the first 30 or so million on an average will go to the PCE and PCE payments. The next $30 million would go to community assistance program. And then there is up to $25 million could be used into the three programs Representative Thompson mentioned, which is into the capitalization of the bulk fuel loan program, or into the Renewable Energy Fund, or into powerhouses. And what this amendment does is it simply adds bulk fuel as one of those choices. Kind of an example is this year we included powerhouses for $10 million, and we received a $10 million match. And if bulk fuel was in that category, then we could have whatever dollar amount that was available into bulk fuel, and the federal government would match it one for one. Right now, there's $300 million worth of deferred maintenance on powerhouses, but $800 million in bulk fuel. And so this would be another mechanism to help assets with that deferred maintenance if the earnings of the endowment support the cascade.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Thayer. We have Co-Chair Foster and then Representatives Josephson and Roll.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm wondering if I could get the opinion from the bill sponsor or staff on this amendment.
Mr. Grusendorf, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Tim Grusendorf, staff to the Senate Finance Committee, and Senator Hoffman. Through the chair, Representative Foster. At this time, I was instructed from the Senate Finance Committee, told me they would prefer no amendments, but our opinion on the amendment is that there are already three competing entities for the $25 million if the Cascades gets to there. And adding a fourth would compete with the first three. All of them are already in your guys' hands and the legislature's hands, because even though the money is there, this body still appropriates. And so you guys pick where that $25 million go. You could split it four ways. If this amendment passes, you could stick to three ways, but the renewable energy source is something that I believe at the time when it was put in there that folks wanted to try to get off fossil fuels and work towards renewable energy sources, and this would just be another competing entity which this body can also just appropriate general funds to, because I've seen to bulk storage fuel, I've seen them appropriate money, and it wouldn't be a consistent match because you never know what the markets are going to do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have Representatives Josephson, Wool, and Ortiz.
Yes, through the chair. For the director of AEA, could you paint me a visual picture of what a bulk fuel upgrade looks like? Because in my mind's eye, I'm flying into a regional hub like maybe Antioch or St. Mary's, and there's a couple large tanks with diesel fuel in them that may corrode or something. But that's sort of the limits of what I understand about it. So what does that mean?
Mr. Thayer.
Yeah, for the record, Curtis here with AEA, I would like to defer to Tim Sandstrom, our COO, who actually handles our bulk fuel upgrade program for us. And so, Tim, could you?
This is Tim Sandstrom, COO of AEA. A typical rural bulk fuel system consists of just what you stated, usually vertical or horizontal tanks, sometimes with secondary containment built into the tank system, sometimes there's a dike around it. There are approximately 400 rural facilities, several in each community, some owned by school districts, some owned by native corporations or other entities, and they are in a continuing state of disrepair. As Mr. Thayer stated, there's approximately $800 million in deferred maintenance. So oftentimes when you look at these tanks, you see a great deal of corrosion. Sometimes the secondary containment is compromised, and that's the kind of project that this possible funding would meet.
Follow-up?
All right. I may have been asleep at the switch. So there's $800 million of need now on these tanks. Is that right?
Correct.
May I offer a comment?
Representative Josephson.
I think I'm not going to, although I see the environmental benefit for sure, I would be concerned that members of the legislature, when someone offers a UGF amendment on bulk fuel, would say, well, never you mind, because they can participate in this program, and so we've got it covered, when this is just incremental. I mean, we have an $800 million problem. So I don't see this as a great way to get there, to the solution.
Thank you. And, sir, can you please place yourself back on the record with your name and title? Our clerk did not get it.
Yes, this is Tim Sandstrom, Chief Operating Officer of AEA.
Great. Thank you so much for that. Next, we have Representative Wool.
Excuse me. Thank you. Mr. Grusendorf answered much of my question, which was, will this be competing with renewable energy fund dollars? And I think the answer is yes. And sooner than later replace diesel fuel demand with other sources of energy. I know we talk about that a lot, but I think it's necessary both monetarily and environmentally, as was stated. $800 million, that's a lot of upgrades needed. That's a little over $1,000 PFD, I think. Just putting in perspective, we're talking about $800 million a lot around here. So that'd be a good way to spend some budget money. But I think I'm going to oppose this just because there's a $25 million amount when the return is high, and there's three other entities competing for it. So maybe UGF is a better way. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Ortiz.
Oh, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Grusendorf, just remind me, we know what one of the three entities were mentioned just now. What are the other two entities that compete for this money?
It is the Bulk Fuel Revolving Loan Fund, the Rural Power Systems Upgrade, and then the Renewable Energy Fund.
Thank you. That's all.
Thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Chair. So to Mr. Grusendorf, can you tell me how many tanks, individual tanks, the $800 million price tag represents?
This is Mr. Grusendorf here.
Oh, my apologies. I was looking for the person that's on the phone.
The person on the phone looks like Mr. Sandstrom. If you could please help Representative Carpenter.
Through the chair, this is Tim Sandstrom, AEA. There are 400 facilities. I don't have an account of the number of tanks. Each of those 400 facilities usually has anywhere between 2 and 10 bulk fuel tanks comprising the system.
Follow up
on that line. Do any of these tanks have regulatory inspection requirements that require the facilities to be upgraded?
Yes, they do. There are kind of two main regulatory bodies, the United States Coast Guard and the DEC, that inspect those tanks. And it's one of the great concerns we have. These regulatory agencies haven't been very active in enforcing and doing monetary fines in the past, and they are currently starting to do that as of this year. So one of our primary efforts is to mitigate the effects of that and to keep these facilities code-compliant and safe.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Butcher. How many facilities are currently out of compliance that we know of?
That is currently the under an inventory and assessment that we are undertaking at this time, that's anticipated to be done by the end of the year. Anecdotally, we know that it's a large number, probably somewhere in the order of 75%, that have some regulatory violations of varying significance.
Follow up?
Do we know of any facilities, thank you, Madam Co-Chair, do we know of any of those facilities that have active leaks or containment issues that need immediate repair?
Through the chair, there are none that meet that requirement to our knowledge at this time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Earlier this year, we tried to get that $25 million cap off of that possibility of available funds, and unfortunately, we didn't get there with it. But a lot of these small communities have very old tanks that are degrading. Representative Josephson talked about seeing corrosion on some flying into small villages, and this was the purpose of trying to get this there, but I can see that this is going to be taking up a lot of the committee's time, so at this time, I will withdraw.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Amendment number one has been withdrawn. Further discussion on Senate Bill 243. Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just want to say I did have an amendment that I did not offer, which was to lower the amount from $750 to $650. And I really just want to have the discussion about it because I feel like there's a little scarcity of data as far as what people are using, how much, you know, and I'm fine to go through the increase. You know, I want to help people out. Utility costs are through the roof. They're going up. They're definitely going up. So, but I wrote to a couple utilities, Fairbanks and the other one in Matanuska Electric. Fairbanks' average consumption for a home on a year, not per month, I mean, the monthly average is 568. That's over the course of a year. So winter it's going to be higher, summer it's lower. Matanuska was a little over 600, like 604 or something like that. So 600 is roughly what a house, you know, in the rail belt, a home in the rail belt is using on average per year. So, and I didn't see any data from PCE community. So I'm just curious about that. Obviously, once you hit 500, the price goes up. So I would imagine people are very aware of their consumption. You know, in a lot of areas, especially where I live, people plug in their cars in the winter and that jacks up their electricity. And that maybe not happening so much in rural Alaska, I'm guessing. Also, Representative Edgman mentioned if it goes to 750, will people even need it in a small home that doesn't have maybe a lot of appliances, depending if they have hot water heat or et cetera, hot water, electric hot water. I think people could expand their consumption through space heat with you know, space heaters, electric space heaters, or other ways to heat, especially if diesel or heating oil is $10, $12, $20 a gallon. So I imagine people could get up to the 750 if they needed to or wanted to, and that's fine. I also, you know, when people are, say, heating with that means, you want them to have efficient homes and insulated to the best of their ability, and hopefully that's available. Those kind of things are available. And also, as I mentioned before, heat pumps, which are in use in many areas and becoming more popular in Alaska. I know even people in Fairbanks, which is pretty cold, have them. They're a lot in use around Juneau and warmer areas, so maybe in the southern Alaska, southwest, and where Representative Edgman lives, maybe heat pumps could be used, which use a lot of electric but don't use any diesel. So that could be somewhere to add the extra kilowattage. So I just, and it'd be possible, I'm not asking you to do it this very minute, but it'd be nice to see some data on what consumption is, what people need, and a little more data on that, because I was sort of surprised that the average home in Fairbanks uses under 600. So when we go from 500 to 750, is it all going to be used, and how is it going to be used? And maybe AEA can do some data analysis and get some data to us. And that's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wohl. Anything further on Senate Bill 243? Seeing none, Mr. Co-Chair, do you have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 243, version 32-LS1573/I, from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note, and authorize legislative legal services to make conforming changes.
Is there an objection? Hearing none, Senate Bill 243 is moved from committee. Thank you, Mr. Grusendorf. This concludes our agenda for this afternoon. Our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow at 10 a.m. However, I'm going to delay that to the call of the chair, because we have a floor session scheduled for 10 a.m. And with that, at 3:36 p.m., we are adjourned. Thank you, everyone.